Hello, my name is Terry. I'm an alcoholic. I think we can say, lack of power, that is our dilemma. At least it was. Sitting here during the readings, it occurred to me that during our lack of power, there was a good spirit here. I didn't feel anger and a lot of indignation, righteousness. Three Al-Anon sort of to look for an extension cord. I say I'm Terry alcoholic? Yeah, okay, I am. And I know Cecilia's having a hard time. I wonder if that chair there is directly under a loudspeaker might improve the situation a little bit. I'm not sure. Anyway, I'm an alcoholic and I'm sober tonight, and I'm deeply grateful to be sober, and I'm deeply grateful to be at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm grateful to Bob and everyone else who invited me. He sort of a corporate head of the committee to invite me here to share. My story is like yours. I have a twofold disease, allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. And in my own story, what was a little different, we usually like to have something a little different, is that I was raised in the middle of a conversation about the disease concept of alcoholism. I was raised in Hawthorne near the LA airport. My father had been given the Post article by his father the month it came out in 1941. He'd made a special trip over, my mother told me, to give it to his son. The son, find these people. The article on Alcoholics Anonymous by Jack Alexander. And in a couple of years, he found the people and got involved and had a slip and got back in and got involved and had a slip, and he died in withdrawal at the age of 42, his 42nd birthday. And so I grew up, I was 6 and a half, and I had 3 little sisters and an older brother. And we were very much aware of the disease of alcoholism. And my mother had 3 brothers who were alcoholic, who would pay us visits, unannounced, as a rule. We were easy to visit. We were at the end of the 5-car line that ran from Eagle Rock to Hawthorne. If you were on Skid Row, all you needed to do was to make it to Broadway, get on the streetcar. When they kicked you out, our house was 3 blocks downhill. Not hard to find. And so I grew up observing alcoholism, discussing it, hearing about it. My Uncle Bill got in the program when I was in junior high. I went to meetings with him. I saw his amend list, a list of names he was paying debts to. I thought, this is serious. I was very impressed. I was very glad that Alcoholics Anonymous existed. I went to the seminary to study to be a priest, but right about that time I took the pledge not to drink till I was 21. Something Catholic kids did at confirmation in those days. It wasn't part of the ceremony, but some Irish bishops thought it was a good idea to tack it on. It took a brave kid not to take the pledge, you know. Everybody said, don't worry, nobody keeps the pledge. You know, have a drink. Those of us who are ACA, that's... Oh, we're prejudiced. I'm not an active member of the fellowship, but I think about 80% of the members of AA qualify for the program who are in the room. Well, most of us go one way or the other. There are very few that go right along a regular path. We tend to either be troublemakers who don't fit in and cause all kinds of trouble, or we create order. by getting A's and being good, keeping your head down so as not to have it blown off. And I was one of those kids that created order. And I went to the seminary to study to be a priest at a young age with my pledge. When I got into college, I wrote a paper on alcoholism, read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, several other books, and that was 2 years before I had a drink. And I share that because it's weird enough to share. I think that's kind of a remarkable beginning. There's also a moral to it, that if you are diligent in your study, really get well informed about the disease and about recovery, and also say your prayers, it won't do you any good. If you have the ism and you drink, you know, if you have the ism and you drink, a process starts. And that was kind of a laugh line, I have to admit, about it doesn't do you any good. It doesn't do you any good as far as delaying the onset of the disease if you drink, that's for sure. Nor does it give you a leg up on getting better. You can't finesse it. You get a shortcut. I think it probably does good, though. I'm not cynical about education. I just want to say I think it's a good idea. The more education, the better. Because in my case, my guess is that with the education I had, I was unable to construct a denial system sturdy enough to carry me straight through to cirrhosis. Before I noticed something was wrong, you know. I got self-conscious about my drinking early. When I turned 21, I knew it was all right to drink, and I went to the store, bought a bottle of bourbon, sweet vermouth, bitters, merchant, and cherries, mixed up a batch of Manhattan, and discovered America. It was just impressive beyond words to describe. And there was something, you know, there's something, we lie and the secrets all around this disease. And I felt something secret the minute I got high. That this is really something, and you're going to be sure not to mention this to anybody, you know. They're going to be looking over your shoulder soon enough. Don't give them any free ammunition. You know, don't bring attention to yourself. And make sure you keep the world safe for drinking. You don't have to have a drink every minute, but make sure you have a line, you know, open. Make sure you can get one when you need one. You know, that was on day one. Right off the bat. And I know I crossed the invisible line sometime in the early afternoon of that day. I went ahead self-conscious thinking about this. I remember very early thinking, you shouldn't like it this much. And, I had in mind that, you know, you should be... You definitely should not be the type that jumps up and down and gets all excited if you have a chance to have a drink. This is a dead giveaway. Be cool. And I thought, you know, being cool is what we're called to do. If you could just be cool and not make a big deal out of this and just take a few drinks. You might drink a little more than other people, but they don't deserve the drinks they got. You deserve more than they have. But keep your head and be cool. Don't make a display of yourself. This will both fool them and make you safe. It seemed like I'm supposed to do that. I was trying to be cool because I thought I was supposed to be cool. not be some kind of excited idiot. And I could never be cool. I could pretend that I was cool, but I could never be cool. Not 1 minute. From the first drink I had, drinking was a big deal. I pretended as best I could that it was not a big deal. I pretended to myself so much that it was not a big deal that I almost believed that I believed it was not a big deal. But it was a big deal. Right now, it's the biggest deal in my life is that I get to be sober one day at a time. Because it's the gate, it's the opening, the gateway to having any kind of a life. It's so clear to me in God's grace. But I went along, self-conscious, worried about that I was going to be like my father and my uncles. But they were madmen, periodic alcoholics, They were just real great guys, bright, agreeable, everyone liked them. And they had a drink, and they drank until they were in jail or dropped, and then they looked for a new job. It was that kind of extreme thing, and I thought, well, I'm not like that. So I have a little time. And I went along fooling around with my own chapter 3. They had us take another pledge. I thought, I barely was over the pledge I had. They thought young priests shouldn't drink at all for about 5 years. Give yourself a little time to find your sea legs. And I thought, I just got done. And they said, well, you don't have to take a pledge to not drink at all. Just take some decision to moderate your drinking, and that'll be a way of, disciplining yourself. So I thought, this is a very brave thing to do, to take a pledge not to drink any more than one hard drink in any one day. And all I liked was Manhattans and stuff like that. So I thought, I didn't like beer and couldn't imagine drinking that much wine. And this is how early that was. And and the two effects of my pledge is that I learned to love beer. And I made some of the largest drinks ever put together in the Western world. The most memorable one of which is in the summertime I had a job in a swimsuit factory in a funny place, and another my classmate had a job being a janitor in the parish he came from and had a little apartment over the garage. Someone gave him a bottle of 151 rum, and I thought, oh good, we should make some zombies the way they never had the nerve to make them. And so we got two flower vases, and some regular light rum and regular dark rum and some fruit juice, and put it in these flower vases, and topped it off with a lot of 151, and we drank them. That was my one drink for the day. And when we were through, my friend was lying on the floor. I was standing up and looking at the clock, and it was 11:45. I thought, good, only 15 minutes till tomorrow's drink. and that's diagnostic, It is impossible for a human being to find himself or herself in that position and not be an alcoholic. You can't. Nobody but an alcoholic can work your way into that spot. That's an obsessive focus on another drink, working against yourself, making the decision that limits yourself, and outmaneuvering your own decision. And this is our disease. And I didn't have enough of a story yet, so I couldn't go to AA. I was ordained a priest, and the opportunity to drink increased. I was not cynical about my priesthood. I was nervous and anxious to learn the ropes and learn how to be of service and be good at it. And I was interested in everything I was supposed to be interested in. I was afraid of people, of course, because they were going to be, they might criticize me. but I was at it. And I wanted to drink like the other Catholics got to do. But I went down the tubes quickly, and I'm deeply grateful for that. I have a warm feeling of gratitude that I got to get sick fast. Because my heart goes out to people who were able to drink a fifth a day for 20 years before they noticed something was wrong. But it was, I simply drank more than almost anyone else wherever I was. I was never done when you're supposed to be done. Whenever the party was breaking up or the social occasion was breaking up, it was just very obvious I had a job to do. The job was not finished. I had to get done before I went to bed. And you either buy a bottle on the way home or stop at a bar. I prefer stopping at a bar because it seems more social. For this skinny priest on his day off to be the silver dollar in East 6th Street at 1 o'clock in the morning, just monitoring the theological, the level of the discussions at the bar. I know it's really pathetic to listen to the level of talk at a bar when you've had a little training. And they don't appreciate the corrections. Went on like that. I started to get more worried and have hangovers and get my bottle that I'd have during the day. And I began to quit. And I quit for quite a bit. I started quitting. And I'd start so fast after I quit that I didn't want to count it as quitting. I don't know if you ever had that trouble. And I went along doing that for a number of months, a year or so. And then I quit one time, and I just stayed quit. I didn't drink for weeks, and then it was a couple of months. I was very impressed. It went out to 4 months, going into the fifth month, and when I had this little shift of attitude, and I began to get a little worried that I just might stick to this. I thought, if you don't drink for your whole life, it might not be good for you. I think you might have jumped the gun, you might just slip out and no one will know what happened, He waited too long to have a drink. So I thought, it's been over 5 months since I've had a drink. That means I have the talent to quit. And as long as I'm sure now that I have the talent to quit, I might as well start. And I started, and the talent didn't kick in too fast. Actually, it did kick in fast, but I didn't have the talent to quit for 6 months. I quit for 2 days and drank for three. Quit for five, drank for one, drank for six, quit for two. I quit so irregularly and so often that mostly if you asked me if I wanted a drink, I didn't know it. Let me see, did I quit? I hope I didn't quit today. And by the way, if you're kind of new or even kind of old, no matter what you are, if there is a little wispy thought in the back of your head that you might have jumped the gun, they say if you're not done, go out and finish it. Maybe you're not done. Maybe you're not healthy enough to quit yet. I just want to assure you, it's perfectly safe to quit. You will not go crazy from being sober. You can go crazy while you're sober, but not because you're sober. And I don't want to make light of different disorders people have at all, because there's there's a lot of disorders that are very much rooted in brain chemistry, and it's nothing to do with any program that can significantly moderate that. But when there is, when our behavior has a big effect on whether we, you know, lose it or not, I think I'd just like to give you a few hints on how to go crazy while you're sober. Simply never tell the truth. And never sit still long enough for anyone to tell the truth to you. And you'll make it. But if you don't drink one day at a time and go to meetings and listen to people kind of stretching to tell the truth, then we just can't stand not to get our turn. You think you're bad? Listen to this. And then before you know it, you've told them everything, and they're very grateful you're in the group, because you're going to be a big encouragement to newcomers that someone could be as bad as you and still make it. And everyone loves you. And you don't go crazy then. You don't go crazy when we're touching one another and loving each other. In that sense, losing that thing. I kept missing things, and I was just this young, skinny priest in South Central Los Angeles, drinking about a fifth a day of scotch or white port. I remember I was still doing the quitting on and off, but sort of not as much. I was resigning myself to being, well, something's got to happen. And then I missed things and showdowns with the boss and promising not to drink. He finally turned me into his boss, and I got to go downtown to talk to the cardinal, and we agreed I shouldn't drink. And I lasted 2 weeks with the cardinal. He showed up at 7:45 for the 6:30 mass. I don't mean out of bed, I mean showed up. Coming across the schoolyard with the children. We have a good taste in timing. It's the mark of the alcoholic. Coming out of a blackout with the little children carrying their lunch things, and good morning. And I said to the boss, I guess this is it. And he said, yeah, this is it. And I lost my assignment. That's a euphemism we have for getting fired. And getting fired is always tough, even if you can get a job fast. But if you live where you work and drive a company car, it's a major thing, so I was on hold a little while, and then I was sent to treatment. I got to go to aversion treatments, and a lot of people don't even hear about it. You don't have to, but it's just that I'm not going to spend my time on that. It's my story, though. I got to go to a hospital where they give you a nausea drug, warm salt water, and an organized series of drinks that will create intense nausea with the subsequent deep association between the nausea and the taste and smell and sight of alcoholic beverages. And that, together with a spirit of good sportsmanship, should keep you sober for the rest of your life. And I went through that treatment like a champ. I'm good at hospitals. I'm used to structure. And I got out, and I was fine. They got me fair and square. No complaints. They said, you're an alcoholic. Of course I am. First drink gets you drunk. Let me tell you. I was very cooperative. And I was resigned. I got out, and they moved me to a very far away from where I'd been, which was kind of the way to do it in those days. And when I went past Santa Barbara, the very first meeting I went to in the parish, the woman said to me, kind of a stage whisper, "It's so wonderful to have you here, Father. You're so young." And they used to just send alcoholics up here all the time. After about 3 months there, I had a revelation obsession. And I had two kinds of obsession, the revelation type and the wear-down type. The revelation type is that after you find out, it's clear, you find out you're alcoholic, you agree with everybody, you've been treated, you're out now, it's clear. To drink is to die. One drink, that's it, it's over for you. Agreed. Then you get a revelation. Yeah.
In 20 minutes you're going to have a drink. Yeah.
Well, I'll be damned. The other type is when you get over the revelation thing, you don't fall for it anymore. And you just don't drink when you get the revelation, you know, because you know, you dummy, you've been hospitalized. It's over for you. You're no good at drinking anymore. You don't even have a good time. You're a depressed mess the first hour. You know? And then you get another attack, and you have another sermon to yourself, and you get another one, and you give a longer pitch to yourself. And after you give a real long pitch, you feel like having a drink. You say, anybody who would still want a drink after all I've explained to you, and after all you've been through, it's so weird that you're not worth working on, and you might as well have a drink. But I would drink out of humiliation that I wanted a drink, out of just a terrible hopelessness that urge would ever go away. You know, this too will pass was not in my mind. It was this too is it. But back to my revelation, I was just, because there's several people who are going to promise to, I don't know, but they promised to do something bad to me if I didn't include this incident. It was the first time I relapsed after I got out of treatment, and I had been invited to dinner in the parish by one of the pillars of the parish, and just to kind of look the new guy over. And so I said, fine, it was Sunday afternoon. But I started drinking on Thursday night. And by Sunday afternoon, I was not in very good shape. But I was navigating. And I got there, and they asked me if I wanted a drink. I said, oh, just a little wine. That's all I could drink. And they were drunk a few weeks. And they called dinner. I thought, good, we're going to eat dinner. I was a little unsteady. And so we got down to dinner, and there was... And I imagined, and my imagination was going, because I was worried that I wouldn't make it through this dinner. But I thought, now that I stopped drinking, my liver is metabolizing this alcohol. I remember the charts they had in treatment. The ethyl alcohol molecule is really a big fat molecule. It has a lot of oxygen, hydrogen, carbon, and some other things. And they break. You know, they break in half and become acetaldehyde and sugar, and then water, and they finally, you know, I pictured all these molecules breaking down, and I figured I'd be all right by dessert, you know. And they had some roast beef and some red vegetables and mashed potatoes, a little gravy. And the next thing I knew, I was down there. I came up slow, hoping nobody had noticed. And he said, are you all right? No, just fine, a little tired. And I was really mad because as soon as I got set, I'd wake up down there. I never remember going down. I'd be just set, smiling at somebody, and I'd wake up in the potatoes. And then back up, it was a few years after that. There was another priest at that dinner, a friend of mine, and I shared this a few times after I was sober, and I thought, well, you know, sometimes you exaggerate things. You tell it a few times, and so I checked it out with Don, Father Don. I thought, you remember that dinner? He said, oh my. Anyway, I got to go to the hospital the next day. And I went back to the hospital 5 times. And the 5th time back in the aversion treatment hospital, I'd had 24 aversion treatments. They'd asked me never, ever to call them up again. I was demoralizing the other patients and the staff. And I got in good shape in the summer for the last drunk, and I I knew I couldn't go there anymore. And I went there simply because I couldn't think of anything else. In fact, I kind of fantasized getting somebody who had a garage where I could have them lock me in the garage and give me some orange juice and water and just keep a padlock for about 5 days. That it saved money, you know. But I never got around to organizing that. And fantasized it, you know. I fantasized a lot of things. I fantasized having a warehouse full of Johnny Walker Black. I worked in a warehouse several summers, and so I know how they work, you know. Little forklifts, zoom, down the aisles, and everything on pallets, you know, and then racks, you know. And I just pictured myself on a little forklift going down. And up. This thing coming down. And if I had that much Johnny Walker Black, I knew I wouldn't drink too much because I'd be relaxed. You know, I wouldn't worry about the supply problem. You know, and so on my sixth detox, I was in a psych unit in downtown Los Angeles, and but when I turned the corner and got to the main part of detox, I was the first step began. It seems to me right now that I was coming out of it. A conviction arose within me that said, "You're going to be drunk again pretty soon. You always get drunk. Doesn't matter what book you read or what prayer you pray or what resolution you make or who you talk to." There's something wrong with you. There's something missing. Some of your wiring is not connected. But whatever it is people need in order to care, that's what you're missing. You can't care. I would just lose interest in survival, you know, lose interest in the whole project. Recovery, you know. Let me out of here. And so I think that was a gift from God, really, because I think it was a grace that let me experience powerlessness, you know, kind of directly, you know. And I had no idea that was a favor at the time. And I got to New Jersey. I got to go back to winter in Jersey at a recovery house for pre-alcoholics. I got there, and they went to meetings every day the way you do in a good recovery house. And then I'll go to meetings. I was so sure that meetings would not help me, but I was relaxed at meetings. You know, I wasn't on the edge of my chair wondering, well, what is this about? No, I just went. And but somehow I was ready. I had no idea what ready meant. Didn't know what was going on. But I began to identify with people who shared. I was braced for having pep talks, motivational speeches, that type of approach, you know. But I was going to be urged to try harder. And people, instead, they had this spiritual jujitsu, you know, the kind of sucker you into relaxing. Hey, you look tired, you know. Easy does it. Just don't have a drink between now and the next meeting, okay? And I felt a little bit patronized, like, you know, you're so dumb. We're just going to ask you to do something easy. But on the other hand, I felt good, because people were talking from their heart about what happened, and there was an electricity. I felt the spirit of, we're sober, and it's such a blessed relief to be sober. Sobriety in the room was regarded as a precious thing instead of an accomplishment or a feat. Something would tire you out. Sobriety was not tiring these people out. You know, it wasn't that, well, it's been 10 years, I don't know how much more I can take it. So I didn't. That's the way I felt, you know, when it was 3 months, I couldn't take it anymore. I was a periodic with a 3-month cycle. And I knew there was something different, and I liked it, and I couldn't put my finger on it. And when people would say, some people who wouldn't be very conversational, and he'd say hello, and they'd say hello, And they look at me, and I was new, and every, you know, we all wonder how they know we're new. Someone would say to me, who hadn't said anything else at all, "Easy does it. You know, keep coming back." And, you know, I saw the things on the wall. I knew this person was not making something up. But kind of early on, when some people would say slogans, I realized they were speaking with spiritual authority. It was coming out of a place in that person that was deep. They had earned the right to say it. And they meant it with their whole selves. And I found myself respecting and kind of being honored, you know, that they'd say this to me, because it was so, they meant it so deeply. It was, I begin to enjoy what's here. What's here is the spirit of recovery. What here is this, it's one spirit manifests in different ways. This is the New Testament. It's one spirit that manifests itself in the kind of a real ease that just being willing to be a dingbat alkie of the worst kind. And I remember walking around the outside of my recovery house. I've been there a few months. And I'd always had this little thing muttering under my breath, "Not that bad. Not as bad as my Uncle Bill. Not nearly as bad. Not that bad." Just a little way of distancing, you know. And it hit me one day, I'm that bad. Like, how bad do you have to get? Were you bad enough to die if you were drinking? Oh, sure. Well, you want to wait to get worse? You know. But it was such a, that's a spiritual experience, knowing you're that bad, because then you don't have to ever say it again or distance yourself. And the only way I think we can ever say that I am that bad is when we know in our gut that being that bad isn't that bad. Being that bad is fine. We have a program that does well with people who are that bad. Unless you're that bad, you don't hardly qualify to be in the program, as a matter of fact. You know? I don't know if you follow that. I hardly knew what I was saying myself. You know, there's all kinds of spiritual energy and experience in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that I can't retrieve. I can't even describe. I knew that I was, it became apparent to me, I was in the right place. I knew that this was a family I was in. When people would, it's funny, in the last year or so, that this little lady from Czechoslovakia or Hungary or someplace would come to mind, because I was at a round robin participation around one table in Morris Plains, New Jersey, and I'd meet this little lady, and she was like the prototypical cheerful grandma. She was nice coat and nice little curly gray hair. She had a twinkle in her eye, wonderful smile. And I thought, what's she doing here? And then her turn came, and I found out what she was doing here. You know, she was obviously a menace to her family in the neighborhood. And I found myself having an attack of joy that she was sober, you know. I looked at her, and I was just so happy she was sober. Like, this is really good, you know. She's so... And she caught my eye and saw that I was new and that I was identifying with her and that something very important was going on, you know. The minute we begin to identify, the coin of the realm, it starts to happen. If you identify with somebody, you know what you're doing? You're loving them. You can't even help it. You're on their side. You're rooting for them. You're glad they're getting better. Well, you're just acting like a human being, you know. You don't act like a human being very often, and sobriety agrees with you. And then you're sunk, you know. You're captured. That kind of stuff. Just this basic. And I know that I in my disease, I live with a fantasy or a kind of a vision of what's necessary in order to be able to stand living. You know, in order, if you're ever going to recover, if you're ever going to get better, if you're ever going to have a life, you need a few things. And when I'm in my disease, when it's controlling my imagination, I'm convinced that I need to become excellent. I need to be psychologically well-adjusted, competent in my work, highly skilled in interpersonal relations, widely acknowledged as being competent in my work. I have to be poised, confident, kind, deeply virtuous, generous, and very rich. I got to be immune from criticism is what I got to do. I got to be safe from contempt and rejection. And the only way in my self-centered, focused self to be safe from rejection is to become excellent under all headings. And it's funny, this thing is shifting into recovery, and I'm looking around at everybody, and I'm seeing that there's three things I've got to see. One is that people are sober, and they don't mind being sober, and there's a grace in it. You know, there's just a lightness and a gratitude for the sobriety. Very attractive. And then I notice these people are not very well. These people have not become excellent yet. It's really easy to criticize these people. You could make a case against almost any one of them, and you could have a right to reject them if you wanted to. No, I don't happen to want to, but you could. No, that's dangerous. But they got a long way to go. Lots of, and instead of being discouraged by that, of course, I'm deeply encouraged. It's just so wonderful to know that life is possible while you're far from being excellent. You know, and that these people are alive. They're in business as human beings. And then right when I notice people with a lot of defects, a lot of immaturity, a lot of, you know, gaps, these very people with the big gaps, you know, are kind. And they make 12-step calls, and they're kind to people coming back. I remember looking kind of closely when people came back to meetings who had had a relapse. And, you know, there was no urge for any kind of retribution or punishment. If a person would come in the room, and you'd think that the secretary would say, "Oh, you're back after 2 years." Think you can just waltz in here like nothing happened, you know? You know what we got to do, boys? Take them outside. You know, there was no spirit of that kind. You know, there was a joy of seeing a person back who had relapsed. I noticed that. You know, I liked that a lot, and it made me all the more happy to call this home. You know. And so I have not become excellent yet. I shouldn't put it that way. I should say I have seen no signs of becoming excellent. Yeah. Overcoming defects of character and getting knowledge that would make me immune from rejection. And one of my big problems, big fears when I was new was that I just didn't feel that much interest in helping other people. You see, you know, when all of us work with the drunk, we don't do these steps just to feel better, you know. It's to be a better fitted to be of service to your God and your fellows. And I thought, gee, I sure wish I was interested in helping people. I was just such a wounded, self-centered alcoholic. I just wanted to get my act together, become well-adjusted, and be happy. And if God and I had some time later, terrific. You know, it's especially embarrassing for a priest who's supposed to be the whole point of your vocation is to be of help. And I found that for immature, self-centered people, of course, this program is designed for us. That if we can't escape helping people and then drift away, but if you just do a few things, like not be late for meetings and not run away too fast, hang out just a little bit. People get your phone number and they call you up and they ask you to do this, do that. And the minute I'm of service, I love it. Because I'm just like you. I'm you know, I'm neurotic and I got my weirdnesses, but I'm basically a human being like you. We're all the same. We're created by a God who made us in such a way that unless we get to be of loving service, we want to burn the place down. And the minute I'm of loving service, I like it. I think, oh good, this is so normal and so natural. Never would have thought of this myself. Thank you very much, God. And I hope you don't bother me again very soon. And if you just kind of hang around, you'll get bothered enough. And what's really neat is when you're getting into a deep meditation about the significance of your own failure in your life, and the phone rings and someone starts telling you that they're worried about themselves and their life, and you can ask them what stuff they're working, and you get interrupted from your own stuff. And I find that we get interrupted enough to be of service, and you get it in kind of a rhythmic way. We get to act like human beings and then discover that life works. We get to connect and act like human beings and have our heart touched and be engaged and be thrilled how beautiful babies are and we have a basic satisfaction at work and suffer. You know? I think there's a level of suffering that's constant. We all suffer about the same. And if you work a program or don't work a program, you suffer. But if you work a program, suffering doesn't mean life doesn't work. If you work a program, we're living and noticing that, yeah, suffering's part of it. But once you connect and your heart's touched, it's all right. Thank you very much.